Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Marjorie Clark with the SOE in Italy.
Bob was preparing in the November 44 to parachute into northern occupied Italy. The time of his going was changed so often. We had so many farewells, and then came the big day where he went. And that was it. He went. I had no idea where he was or when he was coming back, if he was coming back. Funny, because it still upsets me, just because I just thought of this little sailor boy away from home. Never mind me away from home. When London was burning, I joined the Fannies as a wireless operator in an organisation called SOE, which I discovered later had been formed by Winston Churchill.
I was interviewed in Baker Street at the headquarters of SOE, and then I told I should go on a course of training, which was partly for fitness and partly for irregular warfare. I didn't know what on earth I was joining.
They were such a secretive organisation. You know, it was an adventure. Fear was never in anybody's mind.
And I was told I was going on to northern Africa, to Bone, and with a view to joining Commander Holdsworth's unit in Monopoly.
We went to Monopoly. We were taken to Monopoly, that infamous place. I fancied the naval officers because they had a boat and they had wonderful parties aboard this ship. One time, Bob walked me home. Nothing dramatic. It grew to trusting a person and enjoying a person's company. And that's the way it went.
I realised something that I think I'd probably appreciated but not done anything about before, which was that there was an extraordinarily interesting story which he had completely failed to tell me or the rest of the family. And where do you start with six pieces of paper if you're going to try and write a story? We realised that that wasn't going to be sufficient to give the story the treatment which it merited. So we set off on a journey to discover what had been the experiences of my mother and father in this extraordinary period of 3 years.
Well, after the war was really the only time I heard exactly what had happened to him. We never really talked about it because our friends had similar experiences. You know, it wasn't interesting then, was it? We were in a new period of history. The war was already being forgotten.
My father was intrinsically an extraordinarily modest man, notwithstanding his experiences in the war and his achievements afterwards. I think there was also a generational culture which led to people not speaking about these things. I hope this book will shed some light on this particular aspect of special operations, which took place in the later part of the war in Italy.
We'd done a certain amount of research. We'd been able to find out what had happened to Bob up until this point where he was going off into the hinterland in Italy doing something, but we didn't know what. And then suddenly, lo and behold, Marjorie, out of the blue, maybe 9 months, a year into the research, says, oh, by the way, we've got a bunch of letters in the attic, which Bob wrote to me every single day. The wonderful thing about finding this cache of letters was that it really encapsulated for me the love story between Bob and Marjorie, but also setting the narrative out of this, at times, very brutal campaign, orchestrated and managed very adeptly by SOE, in which the partisans, who were at the heart of this story, were fighting this frontline battle against the Germans. And it was, you know, that whole encapsulating aspect of those letters which really wrapped up all of that into one narrative that for me was I think, the high point of the research aspect of this story.
It's a great story about two people falling in love in a time of war, and in a sense of good coming out of evil.
You know, you didn't feel nervous. We were the brave generation. Is that what they called us?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. It's a great honour for us all to be here, and particularly for me to be able to introduce Marjorie and Tim. I wanted just to kick it off, Tim, if I may, by asking you, I mean, we heard a little bit about the background to the story there, but what was the real impulse that made you want to write this book?
I think there were two things. I think one was a narrow one, and one was perhaps slightly broader. I think all of us, my brother, my sister and I, had grown up feeling that there was an interesting story. We knew little bits about it, and you talked much more openly about it than my father did. But my father resolutely, like many people of that generation, refused to talk about it. Whenever you asked him about it, he'd tell you a funny story or he'd tell some diversionary tale about something that had gone wrong, but would never talk about what it was like. We had no idea, for example, what his experiences had been like in the prison in Turin, what had happened to him after that, how he ended up in northern Germany, what actually he was doing running the boats up from Monopoly up the coast on that side. So I always thought that he was 89 when he died, and that in his 80s when he'd retired, because he didn't really stop working till he was about 80, he was still going to work at that stage, that he would sort of move into a kind of retirement and would like to sit back and reflect with his children and grandchildren on his life. Well, he didn't. He resolutely maintained his approach of not talking about it. And when he died, I suppose, apart from the enormous sadness in that, was a sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but a sort of kind of irritation that he died without telling the story. And the elements of the story, which you've heard about in the film, the background of war, the romance between two people, seemed to me a compelling story. So that's what drove me to talk to Nick about it, about, I suppose, 6 months after he died. It was quite soon after. The other thing, the sort of slightly broader thing which I referred to, which led me to want to write this book, was a feeling that there were many stories of my mother's generation, mother and father's generation, which were untold. There are many books and stories about generals and tactics and strategy, but less stories about the experience of what you might call the common soldier. And I think that those are the experiences that people rightly identify with, want to know about. And I think that I also wanted to know, both for our own family, and I thought that it would be interesting for us to see what we could find out and do that, with no guarantee at all, actually, when we started, that we would be able to write an essay, let alone a book about it. And it's a curious reflection. The UK, as you will know, was amazingly slow to start recording the experiences of soldiers. The Americans very enlightenedly started doing it after the First World War. And the Imperial War Museum, I think it was in its 1980s before. And of course, we'd lost then the First World War generation. And my Welsh grandfather, my mother's father, had fought on the Western Front for 3 years. And his story was never told. We never knew what happened. We knew he'd been wounded, but that was about it. He too never spoke about it. So I think those were the general things that started me to think about it.
So, Marjorie, turning to you, tell us a little bit about your upbringing. You grew up in South Wales.
Yes, I'm Welsh.
Yes, and tell us a little bit about where you came from, the village where you came from.
I lived in a tiny village in the Swansea Valley, the coal mining area of Wales, and I was sent to Cheltenham Ladies College, where I became very Anglified, yes. And then I had taken entrance to Oxford, and it seemed a very silly time to go up to Oxford. London was burning, Swansea had been flattened, And I don't know how I was allowed from Cheltenham to go by train alone to London, to Fanny headquarters. Don't ask me why or how. And I met the Queen Bee of the Fannies, and she said, Welsh wireless operator. And I had to ring my father and say, I'm not going up to Oxford, I've joined the Fannies. I'd never heard of the thing, and they were a very strange organisation.
Was that the Fannies or SOE?
The Fannies, on the Fannies.
Well, we should explain perhaps a little bit at this point that for most of its female staff, that SOE recruited from the Fannies, and the Fannies were the first aid nursing.
The Fannies were the only girls who worked for SOE.
Yeah.
You bought your own uniform, and you had to return it at the end of the war. You went everywhere. I went to Henley-on-Thames, first of all, for training, with a label. You only had to see a Fanny, and you knew SOE were around. And then I went to Scotland, and then fortunately went on a boat to North Africa. Well, that was exciting from an old Cheltonian. Imagine 8 girls and 2,000 troops. But it wasn't like that, I explained to my granddaughter. No, no. Great fun, but proper. And what I remember was we had Heinz tomato ketchup. But we landed in North Africa. One of the boats was torpedoed. And I was there only a few months and then went to Italy. Started at the bottom, at Brindisi, Taranto, Bari, Monopoli, Bari, Rome, and then Siena and Florence.
Did anyone tell you where you were going?
Certainly not. You never knew where you were going. It was a very strange organisation.
I mean, it was remarkable how little you were told about anything, really, that you had signed up for. I mean, that, to me, was one of the characteristics that came through in the book as we researched it, was just how little the participants, so not only you, but, of course, Bob himself, was told about what he was signing up for. And of course, the challenge of writing the book, in a sense, was unravelling all of that secrecy. Yeah. Tim, obviously we took a decision at a certain point to wrap the story of the research into the story of what happened to your parents. Do you want to just say a little bit about why we took that decision?
Yes, just to follow up on what my mother was saying about how little she knew. I mean, my father originally volunteered for the Royal Navy. Because he thought you got a more comfortable bed there. You would get a dry bed in a ship, and that would be good. And he did serve on a Malta convoy, knowing that he was colorblind. He managed to get into the Navy by getting the man behind, I think was the story, to shout out the right answer. So he got in. I think the Navy did discover he was colorblind, but then lost the record. So he went on this convoy, where they did discover that he couldn't tell red from green, and that was quite critical in some occasions. So he was sent back to be an administrator in the Chatham Dockyard. And just to show how curious these things are, and you wonder how SOE was put together from 1940 onwards, somebody came into the Chatham Dockyard and said, does anyone here have any experience of small boats? And my father said he had sailed a dinghy on the Welsh Harp Pool before the war. And the man said, you're just the person we're looking for. And that, Hitler must have been quaking at that stage. Flotilla of people from the Welsh Harp Pool coming across. And so he was sent to Baker Street, the headquarters, you know, of SOE. And I asked him once, what was he asked? And he said, well, they only asked me the same question. What did I know about boats? And so it was quite brief. And they sent him to Arisaig in Scotland, which was a training area for special forces. He spent a month there where he said it rained every day except one, which is somewhat ironic on a day like this. And was then sent down to the Helford River, and we can talk about this more if that's interesting, but to train on motor torpedo boats and fishing boats and things. Was then sent out to Africa, like my mother. I think he was 3 weeks ahead of you. He had gone, but you didn't know him at that stage.
No, I didn't.
And then he was sent across to Monopoly. He was asked to ferry a landing craft, I think, and he, of course, predictably got lost. Met another landing craft, which was also lost. But anyway, somehow they made it round Sicily up into Monopoly, which most of you will probably know is a little port just on the a bit up the heel of Italy on the eastern Adriatic seaboard. It was only, and you may find this curious as I do, when he got to Monopoly that he realized he had no idea what he'd joined. No one had told him that he'd been recruited into SOE. So he asked somebody, and they said, oh, well, you're now in SOE, and you're in number one special force, which was the force that was based in Monopoly doing seaboard operations. I've now avoided answering your question, which was, why do we do it? Yes, why do we do it this way? Well, it was interesting. We didn't set out to write this in a sort of two-story style. We set out just to write the story of my mother and father and the background of the war, particularly the war in Italy. As many of you will know, not much has been written. SOE in France has been well written about, SOE in Yugoslavia and in a few other places. Italy, almost nothing. Until David Stafford wrote his book in 2008, Mission Accomplished, there was, I don't think, a single book was there at that stage about SOE in Italy. There were some general books, obviously, about the Second World War. But we just wanted to effectively find out the facts and write it down. And that would meet our objective of telling the story. And so we would understand the story, the family would understand it. When we looked at it, having done it, and I guess we were, what, 2 years in, 3 years in at that stage? Yeah. Something like that. We looked at it and thought that it's interesting, but there's no real way into this story as to make it sort of, I don't know, come to life in a curious sort of way. And we sort of retired hurt for a few months to think about it. And then, well, Nick came up with the idea of saying that maybe the experiences we had, which in obviously a completely different way and with no danger, fortunately, to ourselves, had been extraordinary, would be the way of telling the story and to give some more context to the story of what my mother and father experienced between 1943 and 1945. So that's what we did. We had a go at doing it that, and actually we thought it was a compelling way of telling the story in that term.
And as we heard in the film, one of the pivotal moments was when you said, by the way, I've got these letters in the attic that Bob had written to you throughout the war. And you know, you showed me a great deal of trust, Mop, in allowing me to see those letters. But they were a remarkable testimony to what you had witnessed at first hand in this very secret location at the time in southern Italy. Would you tell everyone here a little, as you told us, a little of your first impressions when you arrived in Monopoly? It was not the place it is today by any means.
No, certainly not. It's just a small fishing village. People, they were very poor, no shoes, black clothes, and it wasn't a bit exciting. The funny mess, we had army food, we had porridge and sausages all mixed together. And for heating, it was a metal pan with coals. And Monopoly did have snow in the cold weather. Well, that was merely the background.
And the rest of the background historically is that at the time that you arrived, which was in January 1944, Italy had not long surrendered. It had surrendered 3 months earlier. Very few people had actually turned up. I mean, very few people to do with the infrastructure and setting up of SOE had turned up in Monopoly. So it was, apart from, of course, the Italian citizens who lived there, there was a sort of skeleton crew of SOE personnel. The first moment you met Bob, your future husband, tell us about that. What do you remember of that very first meeting?
Well, they were two very good-looking sailors, and we used to go for drinks on this boat. And no, nothing, you know, across the crowded room stuff. You know, we just met at different times and grew rather fond of each other, which you can't believe today, can you? There's no waiting today. And we waited a long time.
You had a water win.
Sorry?
You had a water win, I think.
So Bob was part of a small detachment, as Tim has said, of naval operators who were tasked with sailing boats and agents up the coast and dropping agents off behind enemy lines, which was a very hazardous undertaking because the German lines were probably not 50 or so miles north of where you were at the time, and of course stretched across Italy above fierce defensive lines themselves. So, Tim, fill in a little bit some of the background we discovered about those agent-dropping missions up the coast.
Yes, I mean, the SOE was limited in what it could do by reference to the moon or not, because these were done at night. And I mentioned earlier that when he was training in Hilford, there was a mixture of motor torpedo boats and fishing boats. And the reason was that they would keep the motor torpedo boats, the MS boats, Italian boats, which the Allies had taken over on the Italian surrender. They used to keep them up the coast, ultimately in Ortona, wasn't it, that they kept them. And they would sail the fishing boats up there and then change boats. And I suppose there were sort of three types of operation. The first one, actually, my father did was in a submarine, which was dropping an agent near Chioggia, off just south of Venice. Unfortunately, they were discovered and depth charged by Italian submarine. And just as an incident, when I was trying to find out about this from my father, all he would tell me was it took 7 days to get there from the bottom, and it was a brilliant opportunity to read Plato's Republic. Can you imagine spending that time in a smallish submarine? He was the only British officer on board. The rest of the crew was Italian. He said it was he didn't speak any Italian. Why he was selected to go here remained a mystery. He once said that the only Italian he could tell people was to strip a Bren gun. He could do that in Italian, but nothing else. And so he had no idea what the crew were saying. The Italian surrender had only taken place literally a month or so before. So he went up, he survived that, he came back and then did, I think, three missions with motor torpedo boats, dropping agents, but also picking people up. And that was one of the things that was revealed and why bringing the two stories together, I think, worked very well. Is that we could never find out why it was that he was going up to these beaches just south of Ancona. And we went and stood on these beaches, and you know, they're not that much changed behind. And you get an incredible sense of what it must have been like to come out of the sea or off the sea in canoes to a hostile landscape where you can see nothing, and there's just the sound of the sea to greet you. Until we met an organization called ELMS, Escape Line something.
Memorial Society,
which honors and tells the story of British POWs, army generally officers, who were prisoners of war of the Italians and the Germans in Italy, who when the Italians surrendered, they opened the doors of the prisoner of war camps in northern Italy. And these people were coming south. They were trying to move towards Anzio to join and cross the lines and to be picked up. And we discovered, mainly by, I mean, and this is one of many, many coincidences. The discovery of the letters was one of the pieces of good fortune that Nick and I had in telling this story. We met a woman who was turned out to be the niece of a man called Max Salvadori. And Max Salvadori was a famous man in SOE. His father was Italian, his mother was American, I think. And he had operated in SOE. He'd been thrown out of Italy in the 1920s because he was an anti-fascist. His father had run a newspaper, which had been shut down by Mussolini. And Nick and I were wandering through Fermo, a little town near Ancona, looking to try and find the Salvadori Villa, where my father had spent some time. And we were looking at this house, thinking, well, maybe this is also a Salvadori house. And we must have looked immensely suspicious, sort of one old man and one younger man just sort of looking at the house. And this woman came up and said, can I help you in a very polite way? And we said, well, we're going to tell you something now that is barely credible, but it's so incredible you might believe it. And we told her the story of why we were there. And she said, oh, I'm the niece of Max Salvadori, come in. And so for 3 hours, I think, we spent with her. She gave us her papers, her books, contacts she had, and she explained. It suddenly became clear that this escape line coming through, primarily, I think, from northeastern Italy, of POWs coming down, SOE were picking them up on the coastline just south of Ancona and taking them back behind British lines and doing it. And that was entirely due to Clara Mozzarelli, who is Max's niece. And that,
So while Bob was on these missions up the coast, Mop, there you were installed in the signals office in Monopoly. It's the way you described it to me, it was very atmospheric, and also there was a lot of pressure on you because you'd already met a lot of the partisans who had gone behind enemy lines. Yes. So can you describe a little bit what the signals office was like and what your job was like at the time?
Very boring. You're transmitting, and the most exciting thing there was we did 8-hour shifts. And the worst one was midnight till 8, where several of the sets had not been heard of for months. And London was the worst to get because you had about 50 letters, and that's the last thing you wanted. But one particular night, a friend of mine in the Fennet, she was looking at this set, listening, and you had to listen even if they hadn't been heard of for months. And on this set came Bob sends love to Marjorie. Absolutely forbidden. But I knew where he was. I could work out where he was in Italy. And then I didn't know what happened to him because I didn't see him again till they had a telegram saying he was back from a prisoner of war camp. But that was, at least I knew he was alive.
That is just such... It's the key point of the story, and it really is where the story shifts from being one of you and Bob together, getting to know each other, spending time when you could, going off to near Naples. I think you went to Ravello and had a bit of time there as well, didn't you?
In Bari, and I slept. I was so tired. No. We did have fun times, but then we had that time where I didn't know where he was.
But anyway. that came very much at a change when, in around about July 1944, SOE in its wisdom had decided that the boat operations were no longer needed, and that a new kind of agent in SOE in Italy was required instead. And if I remember correctly, Bob was given a straight choice at that time and was told, you can either go to the Far East and fight the Japanese, or you can be given a mission to go behind German lines in Italy. And of course, Bob wanted to stay with you, so he said, I'm going to volunteer for missions behind the lines, which he did. And that then got us, I think, very much into the second half of the book, Tim, which was about the Clarion mission and the build-up to the Clarion mission, which culminated, of course, in that message coming through to Mop.
Yeah.
Do you want to just give a little bit of background to Clarion, what Clarion was, and your father's role in it?
Well, as Nick says, that the SOE had been appointing liaison officers to go up and fight with the partisans. And as the Allied line had advanced up there, and hence the boat operation stopped, they started changing agents. So my father retrained as a parachutist in Monopoly, and then made, I think, 3 attempts to land in northeastern Italy. And finally, for this mission, Clarion, he landed in the middle of November 1944. And it's another aspect of this thing about telling the story through what Nick and I saw. He dropped into a place called Saint-Robert-Roberon, and near Mondovì, which is about 50 kilometers from Turin. And you think parachuting into something like this countryside, okay, well, that's challenging enough. This is parachuting into high mountains covered in forest in the dark. And so they made 3 attempts, couldn't find the drop zone. went back on a fourth attempt, unknown to my father, with a pilot whose proud record was he'd never brought anyone back. The reason he'd never brought anyone back was he didn't really care where he dropped them. As long as they left, that was fine. And he saw a fire, and so told my father and his wireless operator to jump. And so he jumped, and needless to say, like lots of these things, it was the wrong place. It was, I think, 25 kilometers away from where he should have been. And he landed in a priest's garden. The priest said to him that he couldn't stay, not surprising, because he had quite a lot of sort of unholy equipment with him. And he said, but I'll go and find the people who you're looking for. And that must have been a terrifying few hours, actually, waiting to see whether he was actually going to turn him into the Germans or the Italian fascists around there or come back. And he came back with a 16-year-old partisan called Sergio Coretti. And can I divert to this story? One of the many extraordinary things about this story is the story of Sergio Coretti, 16 years old, I said. And he was with my father until the Clarion mission was betrayed about almost a month later. It was about 3 to 4 weeks later. And he lost contact with my father, didn't see him again after he was captured, until my father got a letter in 1991 saying, I saw the name Bob Clark in the paper, and I wondered whether you were the person who dropped into Mondovì on the 16th of November, 1944, because if you are, I've been looking for you for 50 years. And it was. And so you met Sergio and his family. He was by now, there's a wonderful picture, which we've, I'm pleased to say, got in the book of him as a 16-year-old partisan. By this stage, in 1991, you know, I can't do the maths, but he's sort of 60, grown a bit bigger, and he's a tax inspector, of all things, but an immensely nice man. And you and Sergio's wife and my father and Sergio got together, would spend days together talking. You spoke a bit of Italian. He spoke no English. His wife spoke no English. And my father could run out of the times he could strip a Bren gun in favor of that thing. So it was very interesting. And it was so fascinating to me that bond, even in 3 weeks of fighting in appalling circumstances together, would build up that kind of bond. And between then and 2008, when Sergio died, there were regular meetings. It was not quite every year, but they were pretty regular. And I went along with Caroline, my wife, a few times to see them, and it was extraordinary. But anyway, Clarion was there. Again, a mission that was slightly with an objective that was slightly shrouded in mystery. We think it was to try and open up a route going down to Imperia, wasn't it, on the coast, so that Allies could come up towards Turin. Anyway, in a moment of extraordinary strategic thinking, because only a third of the Clarion mission, there were six of them, had dropped, my father and the radio operator, Eddie Cavain, the others came back 3.5 weeks later and dropped. And they dropped in daylight. And so who watched them floating down? So when they landed, they scarpered off into the rather steep mountains that are around there, but ultimately were betrayed and captured. The Germans used to run what they called a rastrellamenti through the partisan areas. They couldn't go into the countryside in the normal course by themselves. It was too dangerous. The partisans controlled it, so they stayed in the towns. But every so often, they would do just a great sweep. And this was, I think, the biggest sweep, wasn't it, that the Germans had done in December 44. And they were captured, they were taken to jail, first in Mondovì, which is quite a small town, then to Cuneo, and then ultimately to this prison in Turin called Le Nuove, which, as you said, I think, once, completely accurately, is a prison out of central casting. If you imagine what a dark Victorian prison looks like, this was it. And that's where my father was there until January. But we knew at the start nothing about this, and we had no way of finding anything out about it.
Yeah, and so now we have Bob captured, as you said, in December of 1944, taken to Turin jail, and you still behind at Number 1 Special Force Headquarters in Monopoly.
Fighting my way.
Fighting your way northwards. And while we leave Bob in Turin jail, I wondered if, Mop, you could describe a little bit about how the reasons for your changing your job from a wireless operator to coding. There was a lot of pressure attached, wasn't there, to the wireless operation. You didn't take to it at all. You didn't like it.
I had the opportunity to change to coding, which was much more interesting. Where everybody was, I could find out, instead of all these, you know, silly figures which meant nothing. So that's how I ended. And when Monopoly finished and Bob was our, we moved right up to Siena and Florence, and my last few months were still carrying on there till the end of VE Day. We came back. I didn't know where anybody was. Enjoyed VE Day and just sat like patience on a monument.
But in the meantime, you had all of that worry, just not knowing what had happened to Bob. That the Clarion mission had been captured. There was no word at all. I mean, even Monopoly, the Number 1 Special Force Headquarters, had no idea what had happened to him. It must have been desperately worrying for you.
Look at the grey hairs. It was. You couldn't find out anything like you can today with your iPads and all that. No, there was no way to find out.
But you had friends in Monopoly. You had other fannies who were friends of yours who sort of, and you all clubbed together and looked after each other.
We were friends. We were small in number, but they were all together. We moved up. We went, one spectacular move was, I went into Rome when it was liberated in June 1944. Four fannies and about 20 Americans. Because the British went on, and the Americans went into Rome. And that was a party. I have nothing else to tell. I didn't know what he was doing.
No. So, meanwhile, back in northern Italy, in Le Nuove jail, and as you've already said, Tim, I mean, it was just the most horrific place. Yeah. I mean, it is now open to the public. You can go and have a look around this place. And we were struck, weren't we, just by its grimness. I mean, the jail was not only run by the SS, but actually the thing that surprised us, I think, was that the SS really weren't the villain of the piece in this story. The real villains of the piece were the Italian fascists, who were much, much more brutal, if such a thing could be possible, than the SS themselves. Without giving away too much of the plot, I just wondered whether you wanted to say a little bit about some of the discoveries that we made about Pop's capture and what happened from the moment of capture to when we were able to pick up the story when he was shipped into Germany.
Yes, as I mentioned, he was on a hillside when he was betrayed, and there were, I think, five of the six of them were captured initially. One remained free, and as most of you, I'm sure, will know, one of the things that made his disappearance from an Allied point of view more worrying was that the Hitler-Führer order was still in force, which effectively was that anyone in special forces captured was shot. There were no trials or anything. It was just summary execution. And it had been carried out across continental Europe with complete barbarity from, I think, about 1941, something like that. And we struggled to find out why it was that didn't happen. And one of the few things my father did say, that he had conceived of two things happening, really. One was surviving and the other was dying. He'd never conceived of being a prisoner. And it seemed to me, particularly going round Le Nuove prison in Turin, and also when we went round, went up to Bolzano, that there must have been a moment when he thought he would actually survive. I think when he was first captured, he must have thought that was the end of it. But I think sometime on his arrival, and what happened to him basically was he was taken from Le Nuove prison in January on a train up to Bolzano, In Bolzano, they were bombed by the American Air Force, who were trying to stop this very narrow channel of communications between northeastern Italy and Germany. Fortunately, the train driver had the presence of mind to reverse the train back into a tunnel. But they were in cattle trucks, and they were in the cattle trucks for a week, I think, with a bit of water, but not much more than that. Eventually, gosh, we're running out of time. Eventually, he was taken to a prisoner of war camp at Moosburg near Munich, and then up to Berlin, curiously. And actually, we have not found anything really out about the Berlin part. I think it was quite brief. I think it was via Berlin, because that's the way that the track directions went, up to Hamburg, and then I think went through about six camps, was strafed again by the American Air Force, who thought that they were a German army or German civilians in that term. And that led to loss of life of people who'd been prisoners of war for much longer than my father, some of them for most of the war. And then ending up in a prisoner of war camp near Lübeck, where he was liberated by the British Armoured Division and taken, rather sweetly, to a place called Zella, which is an Air Force base which was commanded by Johnny Johnson, the legendary Battle of Britain pilot. Johnny Johnson said, "You must have a drink." You bear in mind that he was about my height, so about 6'4", and by that stage he weighed about 6 stone, didn't he, when he came back from captivity. He gave him a drink, and he, of course, passed out. And that was the sort of end of the thing. Anyway, he was flown out of there. And as a postscript, Nick and I asked if we could fly into Zella to try and look around the base and to see the camps and to do that. And I have to say, the German Air Force were immensely nice about it. As long as we paid, as they said to us, at least 10 times, €39 in cash, had to be in cash, then they were fine. But they shared their archives with us, their photographs, some fascinating photographs from the 30s, and they've given us some photographs for the book, and they were immensely friendly. The really important thing for me that I learned is that there are many of these stories. Many of us have parents' relations, sadly now, obviously, with the passage of time disappearing. If you do have stories, do write them down, do tell them, and I think the lesson of Monopoly Blues for us is that even though you start with 5 pieces of paper and it looks as if there is no way that you can make it 6, there can be ways. We were enormously lucky. But it's so important that these stories about the experiences of people who are actually in the center of battle are recorded and future generations understand what that generation went through. And I think that's a hugely important thing. But anyway, sorry, maybe even longer.
Well, thank you very, very much. I think I just reiterate what you've said. We feel so lucky that you've come here today with this story and that you've written this story and that you, Marjorie, have come to tell your part of it, because that's what's really quite unique, to hear it firsthand. So thank you very, very much for coming. And the book's out in September.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.